Lord, I ask you to pour out your Spirit upon this meeting right now, God, as we look at this information that Dr. Collins is going to be sharing with us. I pray that we would recognize the importance of it, what it means to us, and how it affects not only our lives, but also our witness, our ability to be able to share with other people as well. Help Dr. Collins to have a clear mind and just to be able to say everything that he needs to in less than 2 hours. And we just pray that you bless this time in Jesus' name. Dr. Collins. Amen.
Thank you. Good morning. Ooh, you're awake. Respond. Look at that response. That's great. I love it. We're going to talk about Sodom. Why is Sodom important? Well, I'm going to bring that up in a moment, but it is important. It's not something you think about all the time, I'm sure, but it has profound implications for our faith. Before we do that, though, there's always little advertisements. If you get hooked on this, if what we're going to talk about today kind of grabs you, and this happens from time to time, we'll have someone who's getting ready to head off to college or just finished college say, you know what, I'd really like to look into this archaeology thing. I'd really like to maybe think about becoming involved in biblical archaeology as a profession. Now, I know so many people come to me. I get so many students who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s even, who come to us and say, you know, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be an archaeologist, but my parents talked me out of it. They said there's no money in it. You know, go be an engineer, go get a real job, go do something. But don't be an archaeologist. And I always tell them, be glad you listened to your parents. But then they come to me and they say, you know, I've had my career. I've been in science or I've been in medicine, nursing, something. But now that I have my retirement, I have the money I need, I'm going to go do what I want to do. And I always wanted to be an archaeologist. And they come to us and they get a master's degree in archaeology and go on and get a PhD and contribute to the field and have a whole second career rather than retiring and playing golf. You know, they get involved in something like that. And they contribute marvelously because they already have a professional background and they're really, really serious about doing this. So if that strikes you somehow, come talk to me. We'd love to have another archaeologist in the field. By the way, there are several hundred excavations going on in Israel and Jordan, in what we call the Holy Land. How many of those do you suppose are being conducted by or directed by evangelicals? Three. Three. Now, there used to be four, except one of those is now ended after, I think, 15 or 20 years. But there are three, just three. That's amazing. So we are in the minority, and most archaeologists are extremely liberal. They do not accept the Bible as a historical document. There's a whole lot of reasons for that. I'm going to get into a little bit of that this morning. If you didn't get this in Sunday school, here it is, digsodom.com, the website for the Tal el Hamam excavation project. And then if you want to get some updates, and they're not just updates about the Sodom excavation, they are updates. We talk about anything and everything that has to do with biblical archaeology. We're always getting involved in some kind of argumentation discussion with scholars. And so you can text Dig Sodom to 228-28, get on the email update list. During the dig season, which is in late January to early March, 7 weeks, we send out an update every single day with photographs of what's happening, the excavation, what's coming out of the ground. You'll hear Tuesday's theory, and then it'll be overturned on Thursday and then reinstated on Monday. And as we look at the evidence, as we kind of go with it, it's a lot of fun. It's super educational for your kids to really get an idea about what happens in this sort of a scientific endeavor. There's some books back there on the back table. The tag on the book says $26. $20 will do it. Forget that six. Go buy a Big Mac or something with that. $20, just throw it down on the table. Checks are fine. Just throw it on the table, take the book. This will be one of the better introductions to biblical archaeology you'll ever have, because it takes you through the process of how you go about identifying, a lost city. Before I launch into this, I want to say something. 19th century Europe, say from about the 1840s to around 1900, 19th century Europe was one of the powerhouses for Christian evangelism worldwide. More missionaries were being sent and into far-flung lands all over the globe, from Germany and from the Netherlands and from England and from all of these countries. These Christian churches were really, really evangelizing the world. About 1945, Europe was declared post-Christian. Barely one generation, just one generation. What happened? How can you go from being a powerful missionary sending organism, the entirety of Europe, to entering the post-Christian era? How does that happen? And by the way, 10 years ago, I used to tell people, we are precipitously close to becoming post-Christian America. I have sad news. Historians have now declared Christian America to be post-Christian. We have entered post-Christian America. We are no longer the dominant feature of the mindset of the culture. And that's very sad, but it ought to get our dander up, ought to get the ruff up on our neck, because we have a fight on our hands. Because people have declared, are systematically now, categorically declaring that the Bible is not a historical document. But where did this start? This very thing that has led us to where we are now is what led Europe away from Christ. And how bad is it? In Albuquerque, I come from Albuquerque. I go to Calvary Chapel in Albuquerque. And in Albuquerque, we have about, if you add in all the little communities around, 750,000 people. And we have over 400 churches and a few big mega churches. I studied in Strasbourg, France back in the late, 80s. And this is still true today. In Strasbourg, France, which is about the same size as Albuquerque, there are 3 evangelical churches, and the largest one's about 140 people. Look at that difference. What happened to Europe? Because, let me tell you what happened. German higher critical theory of the Old Testament began to convince scholars, and eventually those scholars became pastors and going to their churches to begin to convince their people or put doubts in the minds of their people that Moses had anything to do with the Pentateuch. What they had concluded was that Moses did not write the Pentateuch, that it was written by a bunch of late Iron Age, that's post-David and Solomon's time, a bunch of Judahite priests living in Jerusalem concocting a fiction about how the Israelites can have a claim on the land, on the Holy Land. And so that's what we're stuck with. This is the predominant theory today. It is the theory actually taught in many seminaries. It's what I learned when I went to Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary back in the 70s. And thankfully, they don't teach that anymore over there. They actually got more conservative. That's a crazy story. Usually schools keep getting more and more liberal. They actually went in a more conservative direction. But the Bible is not respected in the world today by the majority of scholars. And so the existence and location of Sodom and the cities of the plain is a perfect test case for the historical accuracy of the Bible for at least 3 reasons. Number one, this is because most scholars do not believe that those cities ever existed at all. Never existed. In fact, William Deaver, I think I'm going to introduce him in a minute, from University of Arizona, every time he sees me at the ASOR meetings, Annual Schools of Oriental Research, where all the archaeologists are members, and we present papers there every year, but I see him in the hallway, and he'll always say to me, "Hey, Steve, you still digging for Abraham?" And that's, it's sort of a dig. No pun intended there. But my answer to him is always, "Found him I have, Bill, found him." You know, we found his world, and it's a big deal now, but he just refuses to believe it. He just doesn't want to accept this thing. But that's the first reason. So many of these guys just don't believe that cities ever existed at all. The second thing is that almost systematically for the last 100 years, scholars who do, Bible scholars in particular, who do accept the actuality of the cities of the plain, that they really existed, have put them in the wrong place. They put them toward the south end of the Dead Sea. If you have a Bible map, by the way, almost never in the Bible maps do you have Sodom and the cities of the plain on there without a question mark. If they're on there at all, it'll usually have a question mark. And so that's why I always call that, if you have a Bible with maps and stuff in the back, that's the uninspired section in the back where all that information is. But so many scholars had just put them in the wrong place. And there was no reason for that, by the way, because the Bible map for the location of Sodom is very, very specific, as we'll see. In fact, there is far more information geographically about the location of Sodom than there is the location of Jerusalem. So I always tell people, if Tal Hamam is not Sodom, then we're going to have to unidentify Jerusalem, because there's no inscriptions or anything over around Jerusalem in the excavation of the city of David that identifies it as that. It's the geography that identifies it as the right city. And we have the same thing. So the third thing is, if a legitimate, scientifically rigorous investigation into the whereabouts of those cities should actually turn up a set of cities that matches that description, this would be a huge confirmation of biblical historicity. There is no other city than Sodom and the cities of the plain that is as doubted by scholars than this. Nobody doubts the location of Jerusalem. Nobody doubts the location of Babylon. But the very existence and location, both, of Sodom and the cities of the plain are seriously doubted by scholars. But there are minimalists that even though are demonstrating the historical validity of the Bible constantly, they're guys called minimalists. They believe a minimal amount of the Bible is historical. That's what that term means. That they believe the Bible shouldn't even be used at all in archaeology. You should just dismiss it altogether. I read this one in Sunday school this morning, but here it is. Niels Peter Lemke says, the patriarchal narratives are fiction, not reality. Israel Finkelstein says that the Exodus and conquest is entirely divorced from historical reality. By the way, most Israeli scholars believe that. I also said in the Sunday school hour, I'll say it again, of all the hundreds of Israeli archaeologists, I can only think of one possibly that believes that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and Joshua were real people. That shows you where we are. Now, here's Bill Deaver. Now, the Wall Street Journal ran a top-of-the-fold front-page article on our excavations a few years ago. And in that article, they went chasing after Bill Deaver, who's sort of the dean of American archaeologists for the Near East, about what he thought about our excavation of Sodom. And here's what he said. He says, well, no responsible scholar goes out with a trowel in one hand and a Bible in the other. I don't like being called irresponsible. Here's my response in the Wall Street Journal. By the way, I love this picture. I'm going to keep this picture. This is one of those stupid Wall Street Journal drawing things, you know, that they do. I don't know, for some reason they won't put pictures in, but they draw you. He says, here's what I say. No responsible scholar goes digging in the Holy Land without a trowel in one hand and a Bible in the other. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why that's the case. Because the Bible, let me give you the worst case scenario about the Bible. Worst case scenario is the Bible is still the best historical / geographical document we have preserved from antiquity. That's it. That's worst case scenario. So it's still the best. And so, by the way, here in New Mexico, I majored in anthropology at the University of New Mexico, so we were always wondering what happened to the Anasazi, right? You know, if we had a smidgen, a half a paragraph of a written document that told us something about that subject from ancient times, the archaeologists would be ecstatic. They'd be going crazy over that. Well, here you have an entire book, hundreds of pages of historical material that have to do with the time frames that we deal with in the ancient Near East, and you don't want to look at them? You don't want to deal with them? You have to. And so in order to be the right kind of archaeologist, in order to do archaeology correctly, I'm losing this here. Let me get it back on my ear. So you have to do this. If you don't do it, I think you're remiss. Well, how do you go finding an ancient city anyway? If finding Sodom is going to be a very, very important confirmation to the historicity of the Bible, then how do we go find it? Well, let's just reduce it down to three just simple things. One, it's got to be in the right place. It's got to be in the right time frame. And it has to have all the right stuff. Now, let's look at what that is first. What's the right place? This is the geography. And I know when you woke up this morning and hit the shower, the first thing you were thinking was, I really need a geographical fix. I just need some geography today. And so here it is. Whoops. Let me back that up. There we go. We're going to turn to Genesis 13. Now, why Genesis 13? Because Genesis 13 is the only narrative portion of the Bible that is specifically written to take us to the city of Sodom. It's very much a map. There's no other passage, even though we can glean little bits of information here and there. This is what we call a primary text. That is, it was specifically written by the author, in this case, Moses, collating this material together. If he didn't write it, he may have drawn this from much earlier sources. But what he's doing is telling us all the geographical details we need in order to know exactly where he's talking about. And so if we use this passage, we should be able to find it. Now, here it is. Now, I've taken out the incidentals, and basically what I've done is kept the geography. So the geographical details are here, and some of the other things are missing, but this is what we're interested in this morning. So Abram went from Egypt to the Negev. Lot went with him from the Negev. He went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai. Lot looked up, saw that the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of Yahweh, like the land of Egypt toward Zoar. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near, or actually the Hebrew word means as far as Sodom. So there it is. Now, let's parse this out. There's a word used here. The word plain appears here three times. What's interesting about this word is it actually doesn't mean plain at all, as we'll see. It is the word kikar. So how or why does it get translated plain? Well, that's still a mystery to me because that's not what it means. What does it mean? It's the word kikar, and it means a talent or, we can do this in New Mexico, a tortilla, okay, a flat circular loaf of bread. So a talent is a flat circular ingot of metal, okay, it's like a gigantic coin, and a flat bread, a circular bread, a pita, or we say a tortilla. And so that's what it means. 55 out of the 68 times this word appears in the Old Testament, it actually means a talent or a tortilla. 13 times it's used in a geographical way. Now, by the way, outside the Bible, it is never used geographically. This term appears in all the ancient Near Eastern languages, including Egyptian and Akkadian and so on, but it never, ever appears in a geographical use. It's only used geographically in the Bible. And all 13 times it actually refers to a very specific piece of real estate. This is the Dead Sea. And you see the Jordan River channel coming down from the north, and about 30 kilometers north of the Dead Sea, it opens into a very, very wide and circular floodplain. So the hills come down very narrow. This rift valley comes down very narrow, and then it widens out toward the north into the Dead Sea. And this is, in fact, the Kikar. It's very clear in the Bible what that is. Now, here we have it again. The Jordan River is going to come down from the north, and it's going to create a flooding, a floodplain. And the Bible says this. There are five passages. I didn't put them in this presentation this morning, but if you look at all the relevant passages in the Old Testament that deal with the extent of the Kikar and the Jordan River, it will say that the Jordan River ends at the mouth of the Jordan at the Bay of the Dead Sea below Pisgah. In other words, the term Jordan, which means the descent or the descending of what? The fresh water system. The descent ends when it hits the lower spot on the face of the earth, which is the surface of the Dead Sea, 1,300 feet below sea level. So there's no more descending. The descent, the Jordan, ends right there. So when we talk about the Kikar of the Jordan, this is where it is. If you put Sodom toward the south into the Dead Sea, you have to really do some stretching, because the cities of the Kikar are the cities of the Kikar of the Jordan, not the Dead Sea Valley. And so scholars have always had to do quite a bit of gymnastics to do that, and in fact, it just doesn't work. So the Kikar is north of the Dead Sea. The Kikar of the Jordan, according to our passage in Genesis 13, was well watered in two ways. It was watered like Egypt, and it was watered like the Garden of Yahweh. Now, how's the Garden of Yahweh watered? If you go back to Genesis 2, it says the garden had a river running through it. You have a garden, you have a river running right down the middle of it. Now, it says it broke into four channels after it left the garden, but in the garden, it was going right through the center of it, a single river. It also says it was watered like Egypt. How is Egypt watered? The Nile overflows its banks annually in the Delta region, and they plant behind the receding waters in the newly deposited silt, and that drives Nilotic civilization for over 3,000 years. And this is observed by the writer, who happens to be Moses, who grew up in Egypt. This is observed to be hydrologically similar to the Nile. It's a Nile in miniature. The Jordan River, actually, not today, because all the water is siphoned off for agriculture. You can long jump across it today or pole vault over it. This is not very wide. But in antiquity, it was never less, even in the dry part of the season, it was never less than 200 or 300 meters in width, and it would expand in the spring melt when the snow melts at Mount in the Hermon Range up north, and the waters come down in the spring rains. Then it would widen out to 3 or 4 kilometers on each side of the river. And we know that because no ancient settlements are built closer than about 6 miles. You build closer to the river than 6 miles, and at some point you're going to get flooded. They knew that. And so they are all positioned properly. Now here's the flooding. And we have all of this water coming in through seasonal runoff. And these represent springs. There's a great big spring at Jericho on the west side. On the east side, there are even more springs because the entire Transjordan Aquifer disgorges in this area. This is the best watered agricultural land in the region. There's nothing better. And we know this from antiquity because at a time, I don't have time to go into this, but at a time, almost every single city in the southern Levant around 2500 BC and afterward went out of business because the climate changed and everybody dried up, except this region. We and all the cities in our area continued on just fine because they didn't need rain. They had plenty of water. They had the Jordan River, and they had these great springs in the area which are still running today. Now, a little more geography of this. It said Lot could see the entire Jordan disk from the area around Bethel and Ai, which is west-northwest above Jericho. And he actually says he could see the entire Kikar from that location. Now, let's look at it. Now, of course, north is off in this direction. Okay, so this is the south end of the Dead Sea, north end. And that's the traditional site of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, That's the problem, because Bethel and Ai, we excavated Bethel and Ai for 6 years, or Ai, and so in the area we know what you can and you cannot see, and you cannot see down there because it's all blocked by the hills. Line of sight does not exist to see. What you can see from there on a good clear day is the north end of the Dead Sea, and if you get over to the edge of the Scarp, you can see the entire circle of the Jordan Valley, the Kikar, and so that's what's visible from there. It also says Lot traveled eastward from Bethel and Ai and pitched his tent near Sodom, where here's Bethel and Ai again, and he went eastward and pitched his tent as far as Sodom. That's where it has to be located. He didn't, text never said he turned right, he didn't go anywhere else, he just went east from Bethel and Ai and pitched his tent as far as Sodom. So that's what Lot could see, and that's the direction he went. So Sodom can only be there far enough from the river so it doesn't get flooded, and all the cities of the plain have to be there, and they cannot be in the Dead Sea Valley at all. It's not even possible. So that's the geography. The geography is a no-brainer. It should be there. And that, by the way, what I showed you there was the theoretical map we developed back in around 2002 and then began to actually get on the ground over there and do the exploration and research. And what we found was rather amazing. But it also has to be in the right time. It just can't be a collection of cities from any period. It has to be a collection of cities from the time of Abraham. And Abraham happens to be long, according to the biblical chronology, the right biblical chronology. There is a wrong one. The right one puts him in the Middle Bronze Age. And the Bible's, everything about Abraham's life is Middle Bronze Age. He can't exist in the period before that because the world is totally different. It's not like that world. Can't exist after that because his world is totally different from the world after. He belongs here in the Middle Bronze Age. And so we have the Early Bronze Age and the Middle Bronze Age, and Abraham and Lot belong to the Middle Bronze Age. The cities of Genesis 10 belong back in the Early Bronze Age. How do we know that? Because Genesis 10 describes the period of urbanization. It's the period of first urbanization. We know when that happened. Happened in the Middle Bronze Age. So if you're going to go find Sodom, and Sodom is mentioned in Genesis 10, along with all of its other associated cities. So if we're going to find Sodom, we have to be in the early, intermediate, and Middle Bronze Age. If we look at a city and it doesn't have that spread of civilization in the archaeological strata, then we don't have Sodom. So it's not only has to be in the right place, it has to be in the right time frame. So that's important. Now, what's interesting here, what I've done north of the Dead Sea here is draw in all the ancient trade routes. And at that particular intersection, you see Jericho. But what's interesting is that we couldn't find this is way back in 2002-03, we couldn't find an archaeological map published in Israel or in Europe or America that had anything across the river. There was nothing on any of the archaeological maps across the river. It's stunning. But look at that intersection. But here's what we know today. Let me show you what 13 years of exploration and excavation does for you. It can fill in your map for you. We do have a big city at the intersection. By the way, the intersection wouldn't be there if there weren't a city there. You only make roads to some place. Okay. All right. But it also has associated towns, lots of them. By the way, we now know of over 124 Bronze Age archaeological sites in this area. And nobody knew anything about any of them before we started our project. Not that they weren't known, but nobody paid any attention to them. And but here they all have Arabic names. And ours is Tal el Hammam. So that's the big one right there on the intersection. Now, how big is it? It is bigger than all the other sites in the area, so much so that you could collect all the other sites up and stuff them inside the city wall. Jerusalem during this period is about 10 or 12 acres during the Middle Bronze Age. In the Bronze Age, Jericho is about 10 or 12 acres. And that's pretty much average city size. Tal el Hammam is 62 acres inside the city wall with over 150 occupied acres on its platform. So it's really, really large. It's in the upper echelon of city size. It's of Mesopotamian size, actually. Here's Tal el Hammam. You can see the well-watered plain of the Jordan. We're looking west over the top of it, over to the hills of Judea. And here we have the Upper and Lower City, the Early Bronze Age, we have the Intermediate Bronze Age, and we have the Middle Bronze Age, all very, very dramatic. We now know it as the largest continuously occupied Bronze Age city in the southern Levant. So beside the city of Sodom, this is the most archaeologically important site in Jordan, if not in the entire southern Levant, Israel and Jordan. So it's getting a lot of press, and a lot of archaeological publications are asking us to write chapters for them now because it's that important. So the right time is easy. Ptolemy has all the right stuff, and it's the biggest site. By the way, I could mention, well, how do you know this? Why did you pick Ptolemy as Sodom? Why not one of the other ones? Because the Bible tells us by listing Sodom always first, it means it's the largest. Sodom is always listed first in the list of its cities. And it's the only one ever mentioned by itself. Now, the others are only mentioned in a list. Sodom gets single billing, and the king of Sodom has a voice in the story. King Bera has some kind of friendship relationship, not only with Abraham, because he accompanies Abraham to go visit Melchizedek, but he's obviously a neighbor and knows Melchizedek as well. And so we need the right stuff in the biggest city. So we have the biggest Bronze Age city. That was easy to locate. It's a big pile of ruins. But what about all the right stuff? Well, one of the things that we consider in the right stuff is Genesis 19:1 suggests that the site was fortified. It says Lot sat in the gateway of Sodom. Yeah, gateway, you got a fortified city. And so you can't just have an open settlement, which there are open settlements in this time period, but you need a fortified location. Well, how fortified was it? It is massively fortified. Here's Gary Byers and I, one of my assistant directors, standing atop the 5 to 6 meter thick early Bronze Age city wall. This would be the Genesis 10 city wall. And here's Danette and I standing atop the upper city rampart system, which is 50 meters thick at the bottom and 8 meters thick at the top, surrounding the entire upper city. It's completely made of mud bricks. It's not just a big earthen berm like at all the other sites in the Near East. This one is made entirely of mud bricks. It took, just to create the ramparts around the upper and lower city, took somewhere between 50 and 100 million mud bricks. Unbelievable. So here we are. There's the early Bronze Age city wall, the middle Bronze Age city wall. These are the southern defenses. And there's an entry into the gate showing that that addition on the outside was actually done during the middle Bronze Age. And they were actually using that early Bronze Age city wall, incorporating that into their architecture as the foundation of their rampart. And here's the drawing. This is the gate of Sodom, and drawn by Lane Rittmeyer. And so this is what it looks like. And there's the interior of the gate, and what's odd about it is it's a pillared gate hall, and this is it right here, and I'll mention that again in a minute, but here's the city of Sodom during the Middle Bronze Age, during the time of Abraham, and it's quite an operation. I want to take you through season 13 just quickly, just give you a quick idea of what the archaeology looks like as you do it. This is from season 13, which just closed down this past March, so we're just a few months away from what we're going to see here. And so there's the site, and this is where we're digging. This is the palace, and let's tighten down just a little more. There it is, and we're digging the palace, and that's where it is. And there it is. Now, I want to show you the difference. This is at the beginning of the season. We didn't excavate here last season, but in two previous seasons before that, we had excavated here, and you can see some of the excavation. But I want to show you what it looks like to take it from what this looks like to the end of the 2018 excavation season. That's the same area circled, and here it is at the end of the season. Now, what you're looking at there is 150 square meters of the Middle Bronze Age palace, which we think is in excess of 1,000 square meters. And it's 3 stories tall, or was. So there it is. And we hope you'll come excavate with us, by the way, at some point. This is just the way it looks. When you dig, that looks exciting, doesn't it? Don't you just want to come dig and then sweep up after yourself for the photographs? You got to get all the footprints out. And that's mud brick. We preserve some of the mud brick, not all of it. And we wash a lot of pottery in just the palace area. We have excavated all or parts of over 1,200 different vessels just in that little space. And we wash it, we analyze it. This is what it looks like when it's drying. Then it winds up on the reading table where we look at the pottery, and that's how we tell the date of the pottery. The forms change through time, and we look at a piece of pottery. We know if it's early Bronze Age or if it's late Bronze Age or middle Bronze Age, and that's how the process works. And we also use radiocarbon dating, which always tells us what we already knew anyway. But it does match up with the ceramics. And we ship those back, Dr. Phil Sylvia and Dr. Craig Olson and Dr. Muhammad Najjar, who's new to our team, but he's Jordan's top archaeologist, who's now officially part of our excavation staff. And our contributors gave us this. This is Camel One. This is our truck. And what a blessing that is, because for until last year, we had to use the little local trucks and we'd rent them from the locals. Man, sometimes they'd get up the hill and sometimes they wouldn't. And so having Camel One is great, and to get lunches and so forth too. This is an oven. Here's some more palace walls from the time of Abraham. Here's some more. By the way, look at the size of those walls. That wall is almost 2 meters thick. The other one is 1.5 meters thick. We haven't found an outside wall yet. We haven't found an exterior wall to the palace yet. The interior walls are up to 1 meter to 1.5 meters, even some of them 2 meters thick. So this is a massive palace. It's at least 3 stories. It could even be 4 stories. This is what we do at the end of the season, taking photographs. This is the first doorway of the palace of the Middle Bronze Age palace. Now this is exciting because Lot probably walked through this gate, through this doorway. King Bera of the story of Sodom walked through this doorway. Abraham probably walked through this doorway, and very interesting thing when you find a doorway and you look at the time frame and you look at the location and you say, "Wow, the Bible characters were here. They were here." Here's some more. By the way, this structure, we built that during this dig season because we had excavated up above and we needed a substantial structure here to keep what's above from eroding down on top of us below. So we built that thing. And we don't tell people. So it's not a tourist site. So when tourists do stop and they go up there, they look at this big wall. "Wow, that's really cool. Look at that wall." Well, they don't know they're looking at a modern one. So that's kind of fun. All right. Now look at these jars. This is from the destruction layer of Sodom. What we're finding is that these, by the way, all of these jars and all this is mud brick material around it, they're all airborne. None of these jars are sitting on the floor. All of this stuff is airborne and smashing against the northwest walls. In this area also, this season, we found what we think are the parapet bricks of the very top of the palace, and they're all melted into glass. I'll show you some more of this material in a minute, but I don't know what Muhammad is excited about, but maybe he finally figured out this was Sodom. Here's another one of those jars. And by the way, these jars, they have barley. Some of them were full of barley, and which gave us great radiocarbon dates with these short life samples. But look at this stuff. Just here's a roof collapse. This is part of the upper roof smashing down on pots. And we have special palace ware. It's fantastic stuff. By the way, who is that? That's James Barber. He's the pastor of a church in Corpus Christi, Texas, who's also working on a Master of Arts in Archaeology and the Bible. And so you can do that as well. This is what it looks like. Now, these are our mud bricks. These cities are totally made of mud bricks on stone foundations. These are our mud bricks because at some point we want to rebuild some of the walls, especially of the palace, so you can see what it looks like. we have people in New Mexico who've been working with us, expert brickmakers from our beloved state, who have given us several different mixes of making waterproof mud bricks using emulsified asphalt in the mix. And so we have four different recipes from four different experts in New Mexico in these bricks. And what we're doing is we're laying them out over the top of the ancient mud bricks, just leaving them there. We're not mudding them in or anything. We're just leaving them there. And we're going to see how they fare over the rainy season, which starts about December. And so we'll see when we get back in late January how they have survived the rainy season. And we'll know which one is the best. If they all do fine, then we got to flip a coin. But see which one ones last the best. And so there we are. Now, just for, there's one of our excavation workers, our local workers that we hire, sitting there. But you can just see, every bit of this dirt, and there's a lot of it, is taken out one dustpan and one bucket at a time. So it's really a lot of work. And that's the only thing that protects us in the off season. We build fences around things and tell people to stay away. And when we go back, everything's usually in pretty good shape. This is private land, by the way. It's not government land, so we can't really technically build a fence around it, but we can get permission from the locals to fence what we excavate. And eventually, we hope to buy it. You know, if you'd like to donate $50,000, we can buy the Acropolis. You want to donate a couple million dollars, we can buy the whole site. But we'd like to preserve the Acropolis because this is biblical-related stuff. And at some point, I think we will do that. Now, you say, well, the geography's just fine and the chronology's interesting and all of that stuff is good, but I want to know how bad the destruction was. So nobody really cares about anything but the destruction of Sodom. How bad was it? And, well, let's look at it. If you look at this, all these roads lead to somewhere. And all of these somewheres have the next period, the late Bronze Age. They go right from the middle Bronze Age, the time of Abraham, right into the late Bronze Age, into the time of Moses and Joshua. No break. They just continue right on. So if you follow all of those roads out, you go there. But how many late Bronze Age sites in the next period exist right there? Zero. In other words, a hole was punched in the Bronze Age on this site, and there are no cities, towns, or villages there for 700 years after the destruction of the city in the Middle Bronze Age. Just a blank. Now, when you get facts, you have to ask the right questions. And here are a couple of facts from our excavations. Bronze Age civilization on the Eastern Jordan Disc with this site, Tall Hammam, as its center, flourished continuously for over 2,500 years without a break. Another fact, this same civilization, including Tal Hammam, came to an abrupt end toward the end of the Middle Bronze Age, and that area remained without anything, not so much as a village, for the next 700 years. Now remember, this is the best watered land in the region. So here's the critical question in the light of these two facts. Why did the best watered agricultural land in the region remain without cities and towns and villages for the ensuing seven centuries after its destruction at the end of the Middle Bronze Age? Why didn't they rebuild? I'll tell you why. It's like a three-legged milking stool. There are three basic fundamental things you have to build a city. In the ancient world, you have to have defensible high ground, you have to have arable land, and you have to have ample water. And if you take any of those three things out of the equation, that city will fall. It will not exist, or it won't be built to begin with. So, in the destruction of this area, the defensible high ground did not go away. So that's still there. The water coming to the area did not go away. So what went away? The agricultural soil. This event was so powerful that it stripped and pulverized and vaporized the agricultural soil right off the ground. And it took 700 years for the agriculture to return to that area, because soil science tells us that in this climate, that's how long it would take for the A layer of soil to recover. By the way, who was the next person to build on the top of this site? Solomon. He built a store city on the very upper tell because they were starting to grow grain again and they needed a place to store it. But 700 years went by. Now, that's the Iron Age stratum on top, but that blue, that purple there, that's the Middle Bronze II stratum. It is, we call it the Cuisinart effect. It looks like the city was placed into a Cuisinart and somebody punched the button. It's churned, it's pulverized, it's just a meter of ash and destruction debris that is ugly and nasty, and it's all over the site. Everywhere we dig, we run into this destruction layer. And so there it is. This is the first time we saw it very early in the excavation. And in the first season, we got down below the Iron Age and got down into this sealed Middle Bronze Age II locus, and we found, began to find, and we found much more of it now, but we began to find stuff like this. This is a storage jar sherd from the Middle Bronze Age II period, from the time of Abraham. Looks kind of normal. So looking at the inside of the vessel, you can see the wheeling mark. We actually stance it. It actually belongs to the shoulder of a large storage jar. Jar would be about that high. So it's on the shoulder. But when you flip it over, you get this. The surface of the clay body itself is melted into glass. This is not a glaze. This didn't drip onto it. It's this. The analysis tells us that this is the clay body itself, but there's something else about it. You see these little black parts, this darkish stuff. This is carbon. This is carbon separating from the silica matrix as it melts. And then we have some other little nodules in here, lots of them. They circle a few of them. These are calcium nodules. Again, the element calcium separating out from the melting of this glass. Now, what's interesting about this is that this is the Middle Bronze Age pottery sherd. This is trinitite from the ground zero of the first atomic bomb explosion. They're identical. They're physically identical. In fact, once we had chopped off Dr. David Burley down at New Mexico Tech, materials scientist down there, had cut this apart and prepared it for analysis in their Kamika 100 down there. It's a glorified electron microscope. And I handed the balance of the sherd, I took it with me, and we went to the USGS laboratories there where they were going to do the test. And I handed the lady who was going to do the test this sherd. And she looks at it and she says, "Wow, nice piece of trinitite." And I said, "Flip it over." She goes, "Oh, it's pottery. Where did you get this?" "Never mind. Just run the test." Okay. Now, they knew where it was from because it was on the lab sheet. But these two materials are physically identical. The requirement to produce this is the same physical requirement, heat index to do this. Now, this one is not radioactive. This one is, slightly now. Not much left, but. So this one is obviously produced by a bomb. This one is produced by a different kind of phenomenon, but it produces the same kind of heat index that can literally vaporize stone and mud brick and other things, vaporize it, and then little tiny droplets fall like rain of it, and it can accumulate to such a degree that it creates this effect on the ground. So this is silica. Now, one more thing about the sherd. If you go underneath this glass into the kaolin, into the clay itself, unmelted clay, there are zircons, and the zircons are like little bubbles. You know, she's putting it up there on the screen. Oh, she says, "Do you know what that is?" I said, no, I don't know what that is. Looks like a big bubble. She said, that's a zircon crystal. I said, okay, but why is it like a bubble? She says, because it boiled. The zircon crystals underneath the glass, not even in the viscous matrix, underneath the glass, the zircons started to boil. What's the temperature of a zircon boiling? About 3,800 degrees Celsius. That was a quarter inch away from the surface glass. So what was the temperature of the surface glass? It was really, really hot. By the way, that melted lava coming out of the Kilauea volcano in Maui, you know what the temperature of that fast flow is? 2,100 degrees Fahrenheit. So this has to be produced by a physical phenomenon that is not terrestrial in nature. You can't get these temperatures on the Earth. Now, you could do it with lightning, but with fulgurite or lightning-produced material like this is not does not look like this. It's of a different character. Now, what causes this? By the way, this is desert glass. Three lithologies, three different stone types, melted together, slammed together in the air of this event, and melted and smashed up against a stone foundation. This is a lithology from three lithologies melted together from 4 miles southwest of Tal Hamam. We find bits and pieces of this stuff over the area. Residential areas are affected by this. In this particular residential area, we have a human bone scatter. In other words, it's like the proverbial cat in the microwave. The body heats up and explodes, and you wind up with little bits and pieces everywhere. Or they vaporize. So this was probably hidden behind a wall. It heated up, exploded. We find wheels of children's toys, beads, typical Middle Bronze Age pottery, jewelry. We have hardly ever found any more bones, because anything that would be carbon-based and water-based would be vaporized, just gone. Scarabs from the Semitic period in Egypt, so we're connected with Egypt. This is ash, by the way, from right around that main gate tower, one of the big gate towers, and this ash is ash fall. It's post-event ash rain coming down, and it is half a meter thick on the exterior plaza, and it is about the weight and consistency of wheat flour. That's what it feels like when you deal with it. But it's ugly and black, and it's full of little silica spherules, little droplets that form because of the vaporized silica from the area. It is now called the 3.7, well, actually, they went to the Latin. It would be 3. Ka, 1,000 annum, 1,000 year, BP event. So it happened around 3.7 thousand years ago, about 1700 BC, plus minus 50 on the radiocarbon measurement. But scientists are now calling this will be published in the scientific journals as this event, the 3.7K event. Now, why are they so interested in this? Because other events are known, these are airburst events, meteoritic airburst events, like Tunguska, Siberia, 1908, Chelyabinsk, Russia, in February of 2013. Have you seen that? 1,500 dash cams took pictures of this thing exploding. It exploded 10 miles up. Had it exploded one mile from the ground, millions of people would have died. It would have been just like the Sodom event. Now, ours is kind of between these two events. Tunguska, Siberia, 1908, destroyed 2,500 square kilometers of trees. Chelyabinsk didn't destroy anything, broke a lot of windows. But the Sodom event, somewhere right in the middle of that, and it destroys about 400 square kilometers and destroys an entire enduring civilization just like that. In just the blink of an eye, it's gone. So here it is. Now, on that part of the site, we have virtually no mud bricks remaining on the stone foundations. I don't have to explain that here, do I? I mean, New Mexicans still build with mud bricks. So that force of that blast blew the mud bricks off their stone foundations. But what's interesting is that the upper city has a 100-foot-high rampart surrounding it, and behind that rampart, we have up to 15 to 20 courses of mud brick preserved on top of the foundations. By the way, the height of that is the height of the rampart. The force went up and over the rampart, sheared off those 3- or 4-story buildings. And they're nowhere to be found. They did not erode and go downhill. That mud brick is gone. It's in the, plumed above the stratosphere. So there it is. Now, what does that tell us? We know the directionality of this event. It's coming from the southwest. Here's another example of it. On this floor, this is the palace kitchen. That thing right there is a very large, what's called a saddle kern. It's about a 400-pound grinding stone. There's a meter stick. This thing is over a meter wide and about a half a meter thick with a very smooth grinding surface on top. It used to sit on a, this is the grinding surface on the side. It used to sit up on a pedestal here. It was blown over onto its side. A 400-pound stone just rolled over onto its side. We found the grain hit here and all landed up against the wall. So you could see there were hundreds of pottery vessels strewn across this floor, all smashed and broken and moving in a northeasterly direction. So the directionality is very clear here. Everything's moving in a northeasterly direction. People say, well, maybe it's an earthquake. No, it's not an earthquake. This is the Rift Valley, the biggest one on the earth, the deepest one. The Arabian tectonic plate and the African tectonic plate are grinding against each other right down the center of the Rift Valley. That's what creates the Dead Sea, the Jordan River. They're both moving northward, but one's moving faster than the other. So it does create earthquakes. It's an earthquake-active region. But the strike-slip motion of the earthquakes in this area are all north and south. And we see that we have two massive earthquake events on our site. And we see the movement, north and south movement. But this is going almost perpendicular to it. Strike slip would be going this way. This is going opposite to it. So this is one indicator among many of the directionality. So there's the Kikar. The cities of the plain are all located in this area right here. And so we literally have a fireball coming out of the sky, exploding maybe about, we're estimating about a mile or a kilometer above the ground, right at the north end of the Dead Sea. And here it is again, coming from that southeast direction and impacting there and destroying everything. By the way, it also took out Jericho. But Jericho was built back up about 300 years later, just in time for you-know-who. They had barely cut the ribbon on Jericho, and Joshua comes through and destroys it. Jericho just can't catch a break. They're collateral damage for Sodom, and then here comes Joshua later. So there it is. Now, let me show you what happens when you ignore the biblical text in the case of this Kikar geography. There is only one historical atlas of this region that is scholarly and able to be used in a scholarly paper. And that's the Sacred Bridge written by Anson Rainey and Stephen Notley, published by Carta. Now, they do have a 2014 edition, but it doesn't change this. I want to show you, look at this. The Early Bronze Age site map has nothing. Yet from our excavations, we now know it is the largest complex of early Bronze Age civilization in the entire southern Levant. It's not on the map here. Look at the intermediate Bronze Age. Nothing on the map except Iktanu. We now know that that's one of our many, many satellites. Look at this. Here's the Middle Bronze Age map, time of Abraham. Nothing. Blank. Now, how many sights on the key car, meeting the key car city's criteria, actually exist there that have the early bronze, intermediate, middle bronze age. How many actually exist? Well, there they are. By the way, I wish I had my other slide, but look at this. There they are. That's what should be on that map. It's not. So, if in the past Bible scholars and archaeologists had taken the Sodom tales seriously, they would have discovered the civilization in the land of the Kikar a long time ago. By the way, it's Genesis 19:28 actually calls this the land of the Kikar, Ha'aretz HaKikar, the land of the Kikar. What does that mean? Well, the word Ha'aretz always has an ethno-linguistic or ethno-cultural connotation. It's the land of Egypt, Eretz HaMitzrayim. It's the land of Israel. It's the land of the Philistines. This is called, the Bible actually calls this, the land of the Kikar. That is a major civilization in and of itself. Well, if they'd have paid attention to the Bible, they would have discovered this a long time ago. But they didn't, and they didn't. Thus, their blanks, their maps are blanks. But we did. We took the Bible seriously. We went and looked, and lo and behold, there are the cities of the plain. And it's big, and it's impressive. And now they're having to reinterpret the entire Bronze Age in the Southern Levant in the light of it. So, we've done seven important things, and I'll close with this. Here's what we've demonstrated. First, Sodom was an extremely ancient city of great importance. The Bible told us that. It's 62 acres surrounded by massive fortifications, and we looked at that. Two, it was a large, wealthy city-state with many towns and villages, as described in Genesis. Has other towns and even other kinglets or princes associated with it under its control. And here we are. Oh, here's that other map. This is the one I like. Look at all that. That all should be on the map. It's not. Sodom and the cities of the Kikar thrived during the time of Abraham. We have beautiful palace pottery. This is just common ware, but they paint it like several different layers of slip. It's just incredible stuff. It's gorgeous. Sodom had roots in the Bronze Age Minoan civilization. This is a new wrinkle in this thing. Very interesting. The Bible illustrates that. We have Minoan-style architecture, pillared building. This is inside of our main gateway. The main gate to the city has a pillared gatehouse. That's not found in any other city in the entire Southern Levant. That's not a Canaanite structure. This comes from the Minoan civilization. It has a light well, and here's Lane Rittmeyer's reconstruction drawing of this Minoan-style building that leads into the city. By the way, it's the Minoan connection through the architecture of Tall HaMaam and the artistry, the pottery and artistic motifs at Tall HaMaam that led us to this connection first. But then there's also a biblical connection to the Minoan culture. The sexual practices of the Minoan culture are preserved in the Bible in the story of the attempted abduction of the angels. That's all I'll say about that at this point. But it's all interconnected. And look at this. This is from Tall HaMaam. This is Tall HaMaam. Crete, 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 Minoan world. You don't see these downturned horns in the Levant, in the Levantine cultures. You see the upturned horns. This is from Crete. So we're connected to Crete. This one we discovered this year. Very exciting. But look at what this is right here. If you draw this up, this is, what does that look like? It's a proto-Ionic column with a column capital. Where does this come from? This is the Aegean. This is Aegean influence on this. This is another Aegean influence. This curlicue motif is pure Minoan. It's pure Aegean, either Minoan or Helladic. This is not coming from Canaan. So we have this marvelous connection to the ancient world, which supports that the accuracy, historical accuracy of that story of the attempted abduction of the angels in the time of Lot. Sodom and the cities of Kikar were destroyed violently during the time of Abraham. And this is us taking our little carbon for carbon 14 dates and Sodom and the land of the Kikar were wiped out in an instant by a superheated plasmic impact produced by a meteoritic airburst event. How did the Bible describe it? Fire and goprit, burning stones. That's what it means. Burning stone from out of the heaven, from Yahweh out of the heavens. That's a description of a meteoritic airburst. This was something totally out of their personal experience. This is the first time and the only time in history that a civilization has been impacted by one of these airbursts. It usually happens over uninhabited areas. So this was not part of their experience. So why would they write about it? Because it happened. And so there we are. And the last thing, and there's that. Oh, that's some more stuff. And the last thing, Sodom and the land of the Kikar remained uninhabited for 7 centuries after its destruction. Do you know when Moses came there, a few hundred years after the destruction of Sodom, brought the Israelites there to Abel Shittim, this is exactly where it is, there was nobody home. The Bible itself says nobody is home on the plains of Moab when Moses parks there. And that's the former location of Sodom. You can even go back to the time of Joseph. Joseph brought Jacob's body right there to that location to mourn him, and nobody's home. It's called, and by the way, the name of the site where they go is called the threshing, it's translated badly, the threshing floor of Atad. Threshing floor of Atad. No, it means a flat, stony place of sticker bushes. The word Atad means sticker bushes. They translate it as a personal name. I don't think anybody would name their kid Sticker Bush. Look at him, honey. Let's call him Sticker Bush. No, it's a flat, thorny place of sticker bushes. And in the time of Moses, it's called Abel Shittim, the place of mourning of acacia trees. What are acacia trees? Thorny trees. Thorny bushes are the first plants that grow up after a devastation because it protects them from being eaten. Thorny trees are the first trees that begin to grow back after a devastation. The Bible even preserves the floral transformation of the landscape exactly as modern science would know it. It's incredible. And so everything about the story and about the Bible is really amazing. And I'm not going to go into that because it gets into climatology, but here's the point of our event. This is the historic high of the Dead Sea. In the ensuing years of our event, our impact event, the surface of the Dead Sea dropped precipitously to its historic low. Within 50 years, it went from its high to its low. What happened? The rain stopped. It's crazy. Yeah. So not only was it an airburst event, it may have had other calved off pieces of it that like the Shoemaker Levy comet, remember that one that slammed into Jupiter serially as Jupiter turned, it hit here and hit again in the same hemisphere several times. This may have been a multiple event. And I don't know if I... So that's our destruction event. And then you have this precipitous drop in the Dead Sea level, which means the rain stopped. Which means this is probably a northern hemisphere or even a global phenomenon by impacts happening all over in association with this. And so I would say to Dr. Deaver simply that if you bother, the Bible and the trial do work remarkably well together after all. All right? Thank you. Pastor, I'll turn it back over.